So welcome to the latest Kleptocast, and this week we're joined by Timuri Yakabashvili, the former Georgian Deputy Prime Minister, Minister for Reintegration and Ambassador to the US. Thank you for joining us, Timuri.
Thank you for your invitation.
I guess the first question for today is, what is the Georgian lesson for anti-kleptocracy, and is it still relevant so many years after the Rose Revolution and its unravelling?
Yes, I think the Georgian lesson is quite telling. I would not say it's unique because it can be multiplied to any other country. And the first lesson from Georgia is that kleptocracy is not something that you can attribute to either nation or culture or religion or genes or anything else. It's all about governance, because Georgia, before Rose Revolution, jokingly, among friends and not only, was called country of bribes and tribes because of the fragmentation of power and because omnipotent and omnipresent corruption. And like even today in America, when you talk about Mexico, first thing that comes to your mind, at least in some minds, is illegal immigration and cartels. The same way people, when they were talking about Georgians, the corrupted ones. So we were pretty much labeled as somebody who is very corrupted, and some people even started to believe that's what we are. So our anti-corruption efforts actually show that even a country like Georgia can very effectively fight corruption, become one of the least corrupted countries in entire Europe, not even in entire world, because last time that we checked, in corruption perception index, only 3% of Georgians answered yes on the question if they themselves took or gave bribes, or somebody that they know took or gave bribes. Only 3%. So that's a result verified not by us or by our research, by the international bodies. Now, that tells you that, again, corruption is not an ethnic or religious or cultural attribute. It's very much about forms of governance. Second lesson that Georgia provides is that you cannot repair one room in failing house and pretend that you are doing good. You basically have to do renovation of entire building. Meaning that all the efforts to have one bureau or one state agency or one department designated as an anti-corruption bureau or agency or instrument is not enough. On the contrary, it can easily become an instrument of political oppression by the ruling elite. Anti-corruption measures are and have to be job of entire government in every single area that government is engaged with public, being education, economy, healthcare, security, etc. Third lesson of Georgia is that there is not such a thing as a semi-pregnancy. So either you do it or you don't do it. You cannot start and stop. And it's a painful process, as a pregnancy is. It's not entirely pleasant. There are some very painful decisions that you have to make. For example, we fired overnight entire road police. Entire. All of them. And guess what? People were predicting that everything will collapse next day. No, nothing like that happened. We abandoned the anti-terrorist or anti-narcotics bureaus, and actually narcotics became less available than more available, because usually these are the institutions, the corrupted ones, who are kind of serving as hubs for this kind of illicit activities. So if you do it, you have to be serious that you are going to do it in the entire government and not only in the selected areas of the government. That's a Georgian lesson. Next lesson is that you really need a political goodwill. It just cannot be an initiative of one or political party, unless this is the governing political party, or the NGOs, or the media, or institutions of this or that sort. It should be actually the will and desire of the ruling class, the ruling elite, that is in that particular moment in power and has very clear vision what to do. Lesson learned from Georgia is that it's much easier to have anti-corruption measures in the bigger country than the smaller countries, because in small country you don't have anonymity, because you have friends and relatives and neighbors and family connections, which is a very painful process when somebody comes to you and said that, you know, you remember me from our school, I have a problem, and can you please help me? And you have to say no, because yes, we are friends and we are relatives, but law is law and law enforcement is going to enforce the law. So in bigger countries, it's less of that kind of problems. So the anonymity level is much higher and it's much easier to implement it. And last lesson from Georgia is that anti-corruption measures can have very quick and very profound economic dimension. It can drastically improve your economy. It can drastically improve investment climate. It can drastically and very quickly increase your budget. And that's probably something that every single country in the world is aspiring to be richer very quickly. And probably I'll just add one smaller thing there, is that when you start thinking about anti-corruption measures, it's equally important to have not only a punishment mechanisms and law enforcement mechanisms, but also conduct reforms that will eliminate sources of corruption, places that you don't necessarily need humans to make the arbitrary decisions, but rather rely on the modern technology, computers, and databases to eliminate this intermediary person that, you know, in the worst case scenario will be corrupted, in the good case scenario will be tempted to be corrupted.
So many people say in Tbilisi that a lot of steps backwards have taken place under sort of new regime in Georgia. Do you agree with this? And if so, what steps backwards have been taken?
The biggest worry when they talk about Georgia now is, look, first of all, there is nothing new happening in Georgia in the sense that, as one very smart man said, there is no democracy in the world that did not commit suicide, one stage or other. So probably Georgia is now in that situation. The most worrying part of the Georgia today is the state institutions, the backbone that very much the democratic states are under threat. And when we have a country that is governed by basically one man who has no official title, who has no inner circle in a classical understanding of any sort, but has enormous power over judiciary, legislative, executive authorities, who is inclined to destroy presidential institutions because he doesn't like president, or to undermine, in spite of the multiple calls from the IMF and the World Bank, to undermine the central bank because central bank is not entirely following his ideas, that is the most troublesome. Attack on institutions. Everything else is a consequence of those attacks. And we spend a lot of time and a lot of efforts to build institutions and to make institutions more popular than heads of institutions, not than ministers, than deputy ministers, or any individual who will be governing for that particular time this or that institution. So the police was more important, and role of police, than chief of police. Mm-hmm. So that was our motto, that after us, institutions should provide sustainability and development. So when we see that institutions are targeted, when we see that media is criticized, and something very unusual happened yesterday and today. The last free media outlet existing in Georgia, TV company Rustavi II, the privately owned one, was changing the ownership by decree of the Supreme Court, which is the very much the Trump up case, like we've seen in Russia, how the Russian government was taking on independent media, exactly the same scenario. And people went on the street, and today European Court of Human Rights made a decision and issued a decree to halt that decision. It's very extraordinary because it's not one individual suing the state, it's a media suing the state, and European Court made, in my understanding, the absolutely rightful decision, considering that, right to access to alternative information, if you want to call it, not to go into the fake news, not fake news stories, was a big part of the human rights in Georgia. So, is my country doing bad? Well, unfortunately, it's not. I mean, the economy is still somehow going from 2 to 4%, which is not satisfactory, because by that pace, we will be catching up with a country like Portugal, even after crisis, in 30 years. So our ambition was always to have a double-digit growth, because we had enormous potential for growth and room for growth, and provide sustainability by having sustainable institutions. So any attack on institutions, any attack on media, any attack on freedom of expression or the NGOs is a good reason to be worried.
So what's the place of Georgia in Trump's world? How are internal Georgian visions of civil society, of aspirations to NATO and the West, changing or being reconsidered now we have a different political reality in the United States?
I can judge only by three factors and three speculations. A, the Trump's word himself, that is documented, well-known, his interviews and the Fox News and CNN when he's talking about Georgia as an exemplary place, how deregulation, how, anti-corruption measures, and how the termination of the ruling class can bring the economic prosperity. That's what Trump was talking about Georgia and its leadership. Second is my personal interactions with Trump a number of times, and his conviction that less regulations is better for business and better for country. Now, when it comes to foreign policy and Georgia's placement in the NATO-EU context, I think it will be accurate to say that we don't know concrete strategy yet. My wild guess will be that it will be in the realm of larger strategy about American forthcoming policies toward NATO, toward the EU, toward the Russia, Turkey, or the neighborhood, or Iran. So we already see some signs, like we know what his position is on Iran, for example. We have seen enormous and probably unprecedented since the Cold War alienation of Russia and its representatives. Basically, every single Russian diplomat is becoming radioactive to talk to, even to talk to, which is an interesting development. It's going to stick for a very, very long while. And we still have to see, actions, not only rhetorics, when it comes to NATO. We know declarations. We know declarations before elections. We know declarations after elections. And we also heard the Trump speech at the Congress. Put aside the rhetorics, the realistically what we see that number of American troops in Europe have increased in the last year, which is a good sign. So one cannot say that America is, defecting Europe. On the contrary, it's understanding the challenges that are emanating from a place like Russia, And finally, Americans are getting serious about threat that Russia poses, not only to its entire neighborhood, but to the rest of the world. And I can be a living testimony of this evolution, because when Georgian events happened, when Georgia was invaded by Russia, I heard a lot that, okay, at the end of the day, most of these territories Russia was controlling anyway. Then when Ukraine happened, people were more alarmed and saying yes, but in the end of the day, it's meddling its neighborhood, not going after. Then, you know, Syria happened, very far from the neighborhood. Then the hacking happened in the U.S., definitely not very close to Russia. So this naivety of political thought here that, you know, when Russia was crossing one red line after not being punished properly, for one miracle it would stop somewhere, did not happen, caught many politicians by surprise, for my big surprise. But now what we see is either attempt to make deal with Russia or to actually sit seriously and think what we are going to, how we are going to handle Russia. I don't think that there is any decision yet, but entire, you know, atmosphere or the talks about Russia are very negative and probably very sobering as well, that will result into some actionable, serious and long-term policy toward Russia.
Thank you.
You're welcome.